Welcome to everyone. This is Jaya Ashmore of Open Dharma. We're just hearing the sound of walking towards the spring where the water comes out of the ground in this valley. One of those ordinary miracles, rock and water. The last couple of shows, I've been giving a brief update of news of Dharmaloka or Open Dharma. And this time, there's only the ordinary news of things actually growing in the garden right through the winter. Things that people planted sometimes in September, still growing. October, still growing. November, still growing. So feasting on greens. And other kinds of no news kinds of news, which I really enjoyed this week. The very unfamiliar sensation for myself as a mom who's often traveling and often with people, to find myself this week reading a book that no one in the world knows which book it was. It could have been life-transforming or superficial passage of time. Just enjoying reading an actual paper book that's not registered anywhere on any smartphone or Facebook page. I had lunch that no one knows what it was or where I was or what time I ate it. No one knows what time it was when I was up in the night with the olive leaves glistening in the moonlight. So we have this kind of wintertime non-news to share. And it's the inspiration for the Dharma talk this afternoon here, called Natural. It's a very, very welcome to anyone who's listening, whether live or later on. Thank you for being here. It's really a delight, pure delight, to have the chance to be together in this way, whether in the same moment or disregarding time. And as the years go by, and now it's more than a decade that I've been teaching and growing Open Dharma, and the delight grows with the time rather than fading. So really thank you for being part of that. This morning I had the pleasure of speaking to an old friend who is just only very slightly curious about meditation. She asked about ways of clearing her mind. And we both agreed that jogging is a good way. Running. She said running. I don't run, I jog. And we tried to think of other ways. And so of course I mentioned, of course yoga and meditation are good, but then you need some instruction, which I offered. I'm happy to share. And she said, well, but meditation, isn't that where you sit still and think about things? And I said, well, not really, because it can be done not only being still, it can happen when we're jogging, dancing, playing the flute, or whatever. And it happens whether or not there's thinking going on. So I loved her thoughts about meditation. People usually have the opposite, that yes, you have to sit still but not think. So I loved her innocence, thinking that it must be sitting still and thinking, because what else is there to do but think if you're sitting still? And it was curious and lovely in a way to feel her innocence and unknowing, and that it was really unimaginable to her that there could be the possibility of not thinking, or that there could be thinking and not being affected by the thoughts. That there could be living in a stream of life that really has not much to do with thinking. Something more natural that can pop up in thought from time to time, but it's not primarily about thinking. It's primarily wordless. So I have a couple of poems from a lovely book that dear Jonathan Fafard gave to me in Tiruvannamalai after managing the retreats there in South India in January. There are translations by someone other than Coleman Barks of Rumi. So translations and commentary by Nevitt Urgent and Will Johnson. Again, two gentlemen. It would be interesting to have some women translating Rumi as well. So the first poem that caught my attention for this talk today, called Natural, goes like this. I just came from there. My sins, apologies, and guilts all got burnt. I've brought back a fire you've never seen before. It says, step aside. I burn down everything but God. And I'd like to just go straight into a second poem before commenting on the first one. Excuse me. Here's another poem by Rumi. Your love makes knowledge look like a blunder, like a mistake. What's love? What's knowledge? What and whom can we know? In fact, there's only one we could know. Both worlds depend on that. Both worlds cry out for that. That is the only one who exists, yet we don't know who that is. So a love that makes knowledge look like a blunder. Blunder is a lovely word for this position in the poem, on the first line, at the end of the first line. It's mistake, but not just mistake. It's mistake in the sense of a clumsy mistake. That we didn't know what we were doing, and then we got into knowledge and forgot about love. We got into thinking and forgot about living. What's love? What's knowledge? What and whom can we know? In fact, there is only one we could know that both worlds depend on. Both worlds could be the visible and the invisible. It could be the love and the knowledge. It's not said outwardly in the poem. Both worlds cry out for that. The only one who exists. Yet we don't know who that is. So just this invitation not to know who it is that something is deeply crying out for, depending on. And to feel the naturalness of dependence, actually. We're so caught up in being in our independence and initiating things and determining things, aren't we? And we're so uncomfortable in that independent mode. We're so uncomfortable with even the thought of dependence. If it's possible to think of ourselves as children, thinking that the adults don't know, what we're going through, and that they're not doing everything they can in their care to help us go through what we're going through in our best way, thinking that we're doing it all ourselves. I remember as a child somehow discovering a secret stash of peanut M&Ms in the cabinet of my grandparents' kitchen. And I could just climb up onto the counter and I could just open the cabinet door. and I could just reach in the back corner of the bag of M&Ms, and I could just make a tiny little opening that I thought no one would know was there and slip M&Ms out. And only much later, after my grandfather had passed away, a few years later, I mentioned it to my dear Aunt Betty. And in the moment of mentioning to her, we both laughed and realized that, of course, Grandy, my grandfather, my namesake, I was born on his birthday. So I was born after him. Of course, he'd put the M&Ms there for me to discover and sneak. And whether it's good to encourage children to sneak, and whether it's good for children to have sugar or not, who knows? But I felt the love in that situation, as well as the fun of it that could only be a childhood kind of fun. Sometimes these discoveries of how we've been children, cared for, or teased, or loved by adults, and we only realize later that they saw us more fully than we realized. So when I was a child, because I had brown curly hair, adults would often say, oh, you look just like this one American child actress called Shirley Temple, who happens to have passed away yesterday. She retired from acting at the age of 22 and became a diplomat. She was the ambassador to Ghana and then later to a European country. I think it was a wise decision to retire from acting at the age of 22, ripe old age of 22. And apparently, though she had a hard time getting people to take her seriously at first as a diplomat, as an ambassador, apparently she did learn the art of saying what needs to be said. As one commentator put it this morning on National Public Radio, in the U.S., saying what needs to be said in a way that can be heard. So people often would say, oh, you look just like Shirley Temple, they would say to me as a child. And I was so shy, I probably just went into being paralyzed, having that attention focused on me. But sometimes the adults would say, oh, I think you really are Shirley Temple. And I thought they really thought I was. And only much later I realized that, of course, they knew I wasn't. So just allowing for this possibility of help coming in these playful ways. And just staying tuned as best we can to our deep belly eyes. So at first it feels like we are a somebody who does our best to practice tuning in to a deeper way of knowing or seeing, which has mostly to do with unknowing, with not knowing how, and just in the living of things as they unfold, a new kind of knowing without words. A capability that happens as we actually do things, as we live through things. Do you know what I mean? I just want to remind people, we're only halfway through the talk, it's actually quite welcome to call in and ask questions. I haven't mentioned that since the very early shows. If you want to, you could call in to this number. I believe it's a U.S. number, so the country code is 1. What else could it be for the United States, but just 1. 626-226-1427. So at first we consider ourselves, we experience ourselves also as a somebody who does the practice of tuning in to a deeper wordless knowing and occasionally taps into that, occasionally accesses that intuitive knowing, we might say. What I would call our belly eyes. What Rumi calls a fire you've never seen before. that burnt all his sins, apologies, and guilts. I love that. The things that we think are make us good, our apologies and our guilts, we try to hold on to those to help us feel some sense of being a good person, because we feel apologetic and guilty and aware of what's wrong with us, our sins. And it all just gets burned. Just as knowledge takes its place, a secondary place perhaps, or its actual relevance comes into view as we find out what love experience is, find out what both worlds depend on and both worlds cry out for. And after a while, which can be a few years or a few decades, it's more like those deep belly eyes or that fire that no one's ever seen is. And there is something that's like a somebody who seems to come and visit and try to stay tuned to that wide open space, big, clear, steady eyes. So a third Rumi poem. If alligators infested the seas, so if the seas were full of alligators, too many, and if tigers took over the plains, lovers would still keep their eyes fixed on the beautiful face of their friend. Some kind of natural intensity grows. So not what we think of as intensity currently. Oh yes, one more bit of news from Dharmaloka is there is now a cat, which has just come. Leela has come to say hello. A natural intensity, which cats show a good example of. Not the kind of intensity that we try to do, not forced or pinched, but just an intensity that's revealed in things themselves. That sometimes comes across in just the sense perceptions, the actual bareness of green or gray or a sound. I'd hoped to have some soundscape from Tiru that I had recorded, but the technical difficulty rules, so we don't have that available. You have the cat sound instead. And as some of you know, one of my favorite examples of staying true to the deep belly eyes, no matter what, is a French gentleman named Jacques Luceron, who was alive during World War II and went through a lot of difficult experience during World War II. And it turns out he later moved to the United States, where he was a college professor, partly because the unfortunate prejudice against people who are considered to be handicapped in France kept him from having a job that was a work that was fulfilling for him. Whereas in the US, he was a college professor. And one of my friends that many of you know who's taught yoga on a lot of our retreats, Katora from the United States, said, I didn't realize Jacques Luceron was a professor at a US college. Do you know that my sister had him as a professor in college? So Katora's sister had him as a professor and had no idea of his experience with his anti-Nazi work, for example, in France, and his experience in the concentration camps there. They just knew he was a college professor who happened to be blind. And she said people used to leave the classroom early thinking He's blind, he can't see me leave if I move really quietly. Little did they know that he had learned how to see without eyes by staying true. And I'll just recount the story that some of you have heard me tell countless times, that when he was 8 and suffered an accident and lost sight in his eyes, his physical eyes, and was then later on at the age of 8 in a park in Paris with his father near a tree whom he loved and so wanted to see. I'm just feeling the echoes of the Rumi poems. Both worlds depend on that. Both worlds cry out for that. A sense of the inclusion of what's considered to be this simple, ordinary, outer, visible world, also utterly dependent and inseparable from that fire that no one has seen, from that beautiful face of our friend, that we would still keep our eyes fixed on, no matter how many alligators or tigers, no matter how many dangers, no matter how many sins, apologies, guilts there may be. And Jacques so wanted to see that tree that something happened. Instead of his energy going, reaching out towards the tree, it reverted, it went in. And by going so deeply and intensely in with this natural intensity, natural love, natural fire, so deeply in that with a kind of feeling seeing, he could actually make out the shape of the tree, his beloved tree, without the use of his physical eyes. So as children, we may think we can sneak and escape, get out of the room without being seen. And then when we find out that we have been seen and we have not been punished, we've not been shamed, we've just left the room, we've just escaped, and then we're back, and it's okay. Then we can get on with it. We can get on with our own deep belly eyes and seeing inwardly what is outward, until the skin between inward and outward disappears. So Jacques found that he could see without eyes when he stayed with his inward pull. And he could not see with his inward eyes if he got distracted into being somebody. Being somebody who might visit that. Being somebody who, as he put it, somebody who wants to be first, or somebody who's frustrated that he can't find the lock or has dropped the keys. And so rather than being right when he was connected and wrong when he lost the connection, he just simply could see or not. And so, as he put it, what need is there for any kind of moral code any kind of ethical code. When that largesse, that largeness, the big, wide, spacious belly eyes are what works, are what allows us to function and to grow up. And nothing else works. It's that simple. If you start on the journey, the road will be opened for you. This is Rumi again. If you die to yourself, you'll be carried all the way to God. And now here's a little bit more tricky line. If you've been so humiliated that you can't fit into this world, your light will still shine through, even though you're not there. And just for fun, it's a lot of Rumi poems, but they're short. A last one that may shed some light on the one I just read. I'll just read that tricky line again. If you've been so humiliated that you can't fit into this world, I think that what we mean is that delight of no longer needing to live up to expectations, no longer feeling demands as pressure, no longer feeling right and wrong as a code to live by. But having lost track of that somebody-ness that used to visit the wide, big sky eyes, so that you can't fit into this world, so it's so big that it actually doesn't fit into this body or this world, your light will still shine through. It's curious that there's that personal, your light will still shine through even though you're not there. It's very human and very personal in a way, even though it's beyond the person. The importance of each one of us independently making the steps that need to be made, that are sometimes hard to make but are essential and are nourishing when they happen. So no need for escape. So the last poem, maybe like dessert. There's no room in the tavern. A tavern is like a bar, a place where people drink alcohol, basically. There's no room in the tavern, but in the Sufi tradition, the tavern would be a place to drink the wine of God, to get drunk on that love, that fire. There's no room in the tavern for cockiness and conceit. So cockiness is that arrogance, which I spoke of in the beginning as this compulsion to feel ourselves as independent and grown up, even when we're just learning and we don't know anything, and that the only way through is in the not knowing how, but in the living of it. So there's no room in the tavern for cockiness and conceit. Only brave and decent people can enter here. So cockiness, it's connected to the word cock for rooster, for the male chicken who makes a lot of noise and struts around, is the idea. Only brave and decent people can enter here. Once you're in, go ahead and gamble. Maybe you'll win. Maybe you'll lose. Maybe you'll end up checkmated. So just feeling that endlessness, that even if we get checkmated by God, what more could we want? What better way to be there? Thank you very much for listening today. I hope you've enjoyed your own connection while listening. Feel free to listen to other talks from our website, opendharma.org. And also please let me know if you enjoyed the talk, if you have any feedback through the Facebook page of Open Dharma. Thank you. Namaste.